This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra very special guest. His name is Bill McBride. He is the founder and runs the website Calculated Risk, one of, if not the best economic blogs out there, according to pretty much everybody. So this was not my typical podcast. In the regular interview, what I'm supposed to be doing is asking questions and listening to what the guest responds and asking follow-up questions and going, yes. But here's the thing. I know Bill since the first day he started blogging. We were exchanging emails. I was linking to him. I think I could honestly say I linked to Calculated Risk before anybody had any idea who they were. And I have been using his research and his charts for the better part of, 10, 11 years. And we have always had an email relationship. I think we had a couple of telephone conversations, but I had never met Bill before until the night before we recorded this podcast. We went to dinner. And I purposefully, with eight people, I purposefully did not speak to Bill and told him, I'm not going to talk to you until the two of us are in the studio. And so this is supposed to be an interview, but it's not. It's supposed to be a podcast Q&A, but it really is a genuine conversation between two people who know each other for a decade and really have never sat down and had a conversation before. So if you're looking for the usual Q&A that I try and provide each week on the show, this isn't it. This is me and Bill just shooting the breeze. It's two guys who know and respect each other for a long time, and I found it illuminating and fascinating. There's probably too much of me in it relative to what should be, so I'll apologize for that in advance. But hey, if you've ever known someone for what seems like forever, but never met them, when you finally get to meet them, there's going to be a lot of back and forth. And truth be told, I thought the conversation was fascinating. I'm biased, so let me stop babbling, because you'll hear enough of that throughout the rest of the interview. With no further ado, my two-hour bull session with Bill McBride of Calculated Risk.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I have a very special guest. He is somebody I have known for quite a long time. Let me give you a quick background on Bill McBride, who is the proprietor of Calculated Risk. He launched the website in 2005. The idea behind it, let's put simple, opinion-free analysis and charts about economic data out in public where everyone can easily access it and understand it. It has been called the best of the economic blogs by such luminaries as Paul Krugman, The Wall Street Journal, Business Week, Time. Pretty much everybody puts the blog in its list of top 20 or top 50 or top 100 or top 10 blogs. Bill's background is he has an MBA from University of California, Irvine, with a background in management, finance, and economics, and he had been running a public company or involved in a public company in the 1990s when he retired and was looking for something to do. Bill McBride, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks for having me, Barry.
Let's start with your background. So you're running a public company. You're one of the co-founders of a medical devices company, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. I was the head of R&D.
So tell us about this. What was this company about? Ultimately, it got sold to a larger company?
Yeah, well, we started it in the 80s. Mm-hmm. We were designing cardiac telemetry.
Which is?
It's like a little box that you wear on you in the hospital that connects to picks up your ECG, mm-hmm, and sends it to a central monitor in the hospital. It's for in-hospital use.
Did you have a background in medicine?
I had worked previously at a telecommunications company.
So it was more technology than medical.
Yes, and my undergraduate degree is in chemistry. So, mm-hmm, I, it was kind of a mix of things.
Right.
And so what we did is we we kind of revolutionized that industry, because in the 80s was when everybody was making the transition to digital in a lot of different areas.
Uh-huh.
And we used some of the cell phone technology to make the first digital cardiac telemetry.
So when someone gets an EKG in a hospital, or the monitoring?
If you're in particular wards in the hospital, post-cardiac surgery, mm-hmm. if they like to take you off the bedside monitor and put you on a little telemetry unit so you can get up and walk around and still be monitored.
Okay.
And so that's the use for it. We also pick up other parameters in addition to ECG. And then we send it back to a central monitor with they can have a nurse's station. They can monitor the people walking around the hospital.
So what happened with this company in the 90s?
Oh, well, we grew very quickly. We designed telemetry for most of the major medical device companies. They started using ours under their own name. And then we took it public in 96, mm-hmm. and then sold it to GE Medical.
And at that point, you are gainfully unemployed.
That's correct.
As one of the founders. So the site launches in 05. What led you to say, I have an idea, let's analyze economic data?
Well, economics is always a hobby for me. And mm-hmm. I specialized that, and when I got my MBA, that was my focus. In the early 2000s, I had a few things that I was doing. In 2004, I remember thinking, what is a blog? And I think I stumbled across yours, Big Picture. If you remember Angry Bear, when it was written
sure.
by the three PhD economists.
Yes.
And so that kind of inspired me. I said, well, you know, to really understand it, I'll just do one. So I'll start a blog, but I'm not going to write it about politics like most of the blogs I saw.
Right.
And what I want to focus on is housing, because of what I was seeing in Southern California.
It had just gone off the rails.
Yeah, you know, I was at the gym one day, and I was talking to this attractive young lady who was a secretary mm-hmm. for the Hurley T-shirt company.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I know Hurley Surf and
yeah,
all that
exactly.
fun stuff.
And one day she came in and she goes, Bill, I just bought a condo. Now, this condo she bought for $400,000+, and she had already told me she'd moved up
this
a little.
This is an 04.
This is an 04. And she was probably making, you know, she had gotten up to about $40,000 a year in income.
So
at Hurley.
That's forget the old rule of two times.
That's
your
10 to 1 with no money down.
Mm-hmm.
And so after she told me the story, I said, well, how can you afford that? When she started telling me about the teaser rate she had for the first year or two, and I said, well, what happens when that comes due? And she goes, well, I'll just either, you know, I will have more income, or I'll sell the unit. And I thought, well, gee, if this is happening all over the place, there's going to be no one to sell it to.
Right.
So I went home that day and started calling, you know, some mortgage bankers I knew. And I said, is this really possible? Oh, yeah. You know, you don't have to have, you know, anything. No income, you know, the ninja loans. No income, no job. You know,
no assets.
She was a great client. She had a job, you know.
Okay, so you launched the blog, and you decided to do something a little different than most blogs. Calculated risk is fairly opinion-free. Every now and then, and it's much more rare than the average blog, you'll come out and say, this is my opinion about XYZ. I mean, that's like an annual event. Most of the time, you're just saying, here's the data, here's what it means, here's
a
chart.
I do slip in a sentence or two here and there about what I think is happening with that data. And then every once in a while, I will, like you're saying, write a overview piece of where I think we are in the economy and where we're going. And, you know, back in 2005, one of the things I focused on was I was actually calling up regulators and asking them why they're not doing anything. So I would write about how, well, gee, the regulators are not doing their job, and here's why.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest this week is Bill McBride. He is the founder and chief author of the highly regarded economics blog, Calculated Risk. Let's jump right back into this. You've developed an expertise in mortgages and housing and real estate economics. Was that something that you had done in a previous life, or is it just you gravitated it towards that because you were in Southern California and real estate in the early 2000s had just gone insane in California?
Well, it really is a combination of things. My dad was in real estate.
And he was?
And he was a builder.
Oh, no kidding. My mother was a real estate agent.
Yeah,
so it was always separate. time conversation. Did you have that sort of experience?
Yeah, well, I at least saw what he was doing and chatted with him about it. You know, after I started my career, I was more science and technology oriented, but I always have been interested in real estate. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, I had that little bit of a background of what they went through, and I saw my dad go through the ups and downs.
Where was he a builder? What part of the country?
In down in San Diego.
Ah, so that was really an interesting and fast growing, but your dad was in the Navy.
Right.
There's a huge naval base in San. In fact, I think
that's how we ended up there.
That makes sense. Yes. Coronado Island and that whole area.
Right.
So we went from the Navy to San Diego and housing. So post-war, that had to be just a huge boom over there.
Oh, San Diego was booming the whole time. We moved there when I was 5. And so, you know, I was there until I went away to college. It was boom time. Back in the 60s and 70s.
Sure.
But even then, there were big waves.
Cycles.
Yes. You could see the ups and downs. There were times when my dad was clearly struggling financially. You mm-hmm. know, luckily my mom was a elementary school principal. So she had a good steady income, so they could offset each other.
But, so how do you respond to the comment that was everywhere back in the early 2000s? You know, we've never had a downturn in the price of housing in the United States.
Well, first of all, that's not true.
It's utterly false. There have been repeated examples all the way back to the Great Depression.
You know, but one of the things is, if you remember, I'm sure you do, back in 2005, is the data wasn't very good or very available, especially on house prices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had the what's now the FHFA.
Right.
House price index just based on the Fannie and Freddie mortgages.
Right.
But we didn't have Case-Shiller publicly available or CoreLogic publicly
That's
available
right.
or several of the other, you know, Zillow, that wasn't even somebody's thought yet.
Right.
You know, and so now we have so much better data, and some of those guys, Case-Shiller and CoreLogic, have published their data back to previous times, and you can see those ups and downs. And so the people that were saying there were no ups and downs, there was no real good data for them to make that argument. And obviously, they had never lived in Southern California because I'd seen the ups and downs in the house prices.
Absolutely.
And there was a real boom in the 80s. House prices peaked around 1990 in my area, and they slid all the way till 1996.
The same exact experience in New York. 1987 crash shakes Wall Street a little bit. Alan Greenspan cuts rates. You have a little bit of a surge in real estate throughout the 80s, and then it rolled over. If you bought a condo or a co-op in New York in 1989, you did not get back to break even on that purchase price till 1996, plus or minus. And you can see in the charts. But during the Great Depression, we know real estate prices plummeted. And I think it was someone at Columbia, I'm not positive, did a study on Manhattan real estate. And they estimated that real estate prices dropped 70% during the Great Depression. I mean, how do you just shrug that off in your models? It's impossible.
I never understood why people say real estate prices never go down. I never understood it because there's plenty of evidence. Even though we don't have the data that we have today, there is still plenty of evidence.
So let's talk about, I've been using the charts and the information you put on Calculated Risk.
Well, thank
risk
you, too. I appreciate that.
For how long? I mean, it's got to be...
12 years, probably. 10
right?
years, at least.
At least a decade. And I got into a fight with the Wall Street Journal about, it was, I want to say, 06 or 07, and they were doing the, look, real estate prices are improving, and the response was... Well, no, it's June. You're looking at it month over month. You have to look at it year over year.
Right.
So I grabbed, and I brought a copy of it. I'll put it up on the site. I grabbed your existing home sales year over year by month. That shows the same seasonality.
Right.
You know, it's at its nadir in December and January. It slowly rises throughout the spring, peaks later in the fall, and rolls off. You can't just look at June versus February and say, oh, housing is fine. But that's what a lot of media was doing.
Yeah, I think that was one of the issues back in 2005 was the media. I don't think they really knew how to report housing. There were some, but to say that people missed it completely is wrong. There were some excellent articles.
For sure.
And there were some award-winning articles. And
Give us some names.
David Stretfield, who was at the LA Times at the time, mm-hmm. now he's the New York Times. He won awards for his housing articles. They were excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, there were plenty of good articles, but I think they got lost in the bad articles. And you know how the balanced media works.
False equivalency.
Yeah, if you talk to somebody who was very concerned about housing and could make a good argument on making bad mortgages, they would always go talk to somebody who was impressive background, who would say, oh, and house prices never go down.
Right.
There's nothing to worry about, you know. And so I think for the average person who's getting their information that way, it was difficult to see that there was a big problem. Now, I run into people all the time that say, you know, I thought there was something really wrong. So most people in the back of their minds, especially people in areas like, you know, Southern California, Florida, you know, Nevada, they were thinking, I think a lot of people were going, there's something wrong here.
How much of that is hindsight bias where, but by the way,
of course, it could be.
You recall the number of people legitimately in print in a verifiable way warning about housing prices. There were a handful of people, a handful of us. You were one.
Well, you, me, you know, I know a few other people that were doing it. So.
But now every person I met, of course I knew the housing crisis was about to collapse.
I just
looked at certain data and said this ratio, which has been consistent, home price to median income, the cost of renting versus cost of owning. You covered a ton of this stuff. How frustrating was it when you saw the train wreck coming? But you couldn't really convince the average person that, hey, something wicked this way comes.
Well, you know, I was really focused on trying to get the regulators to pay attention to it, and that was a very frustrating process because they were paying attention to it, but they couldn't do anything. Their hands were tied. And you know, the regular person, you know, I started my blog. I was writing for friends and relatives, you know, so I was mostly just saying, hey, you know, if they asked me, I would tell them, don't buy, please don't buy anything, you know. You put a blog out there in public and all of a sudden people start reading it.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest this week is Bill McBride. He is the founder of the Calculated Risk website, lauded by everyone from Business Week, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, as the single best economics blog there is. I put out a request on The Big Picture as well as on Twitter if any of your readers had questions for you, and I got a long list of stuff. Let's jump into some of them. I think some of these are really interesting. First question. You are one of the few bloggers who still maintains a comment section, and it's a mess. Sorry, but I think that's honest. Why maintain comments?
That's a great question. And comments early in the blog were unbelievably outstanding.
Amazing. Amazing.
As a matter of fact, I thought the comments were one of the key elements to the blog.
100%.
The comments turned more into just a chat session about unrelated information.
Off topic. Trolls, spam. It's gone off the rails.
Yeah, well, you know.
Because, NPR, by the way, just killed their comment section.
Yeah, we do have a comment section where people have to register.
Right.
So you can't just get the drive-by commenters.
Right.
So the trolling goes down. But it's basically off topic most of the time.
Right. BuzzFeed does this thing now where you can comment, but only if you register through Facebook, which is your real identity. So you lose a lot of the really off-the-chain, racist nonsense.
Yeah, you know, and we don't have that for the most part. Those people that are racist or bigoted in some way, we've tried to ban.
Right.
But I keep it because a lot of the old-timers are still there. But they chat more than the economic content, and they're kind of friends. So they I leave it for them. If people don't like the comments, then don't participate.
Don't
in
read
comment.
The comments.
Exactly, that's my view. And if there's ever the anti-Semitic things, I've banned so many people from that.
It gets to be a giant curation time suck. It's
yeah.
so complicated. I had some people write me when I killed comments on The Big Picture, which is years ago. Well, thanks for the site, but I'm done. If you don't have comments, you don't understand how many hours a week it is to maintain the comments. And you guys don't see the really horrific comments, and it just got to be a total drag. But that was a lost era. I thought the comments were fantastic. On you could read a really interesting article and then spend a half hour reading some really smart, insightful feedback on that article.
I'm sure some of your commenters were outstanding. Many of mine were. I'm sure we're going to talk about my co-blogger Tanta at some point. I met Tanta through the comments.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she showed up and was commenting, and every time she would either correct something I had said if I said something about the mortgage industry, and I would call up my mortgage banker friends, and they go, "Oh yeah, she's right." So I'd instantly correct it on my blog, and I'd credit Tanta, or she would say, "Hey, yeah, that's she was really sharp. She knew everything, and she was very quick-witted." And so that's how I actually got to know my co-blogger, through the comments. That's where I met her.
So let's talk about that. She starts writing for you in...
Well, this is what happened. And she commented a lot in 2005. Mm-hmm. In 2006, she disappeared from the comments. About 6 months later, she reappeared, and she told me that she had been diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer, had left her job, and she had stopped commenting because she wasn't able to, and she didn't even think she was going to live. Mm-hmm. And so I then asked her, "Well, why don't you come and write for the blog if you're not working?" Because she's working in the mortgage industry.
Right.
And it took me a little convincing, but she started I think her first post was in December 2006. And almost 2 years before she passed away.
So she was a regular on the site for a while, but ultimately succumbed to the illness.
Yes, but she was stunning. Before she started writing for the blog, I probably wrote longer pieces. Mm-hmm. And then when she showed up, her undergraduate degree was in literature. Right. Her pieces were brilliant. One of her goals, she said, was to make blogs entries could be long and still well read, which she accomplished. She would explain mortgage issues in complete detail, and all that stuff still on the blog. People from the Federal Reserve were crediting her in papers they were writing because they were learning from her too. And she was a real mortgage banker. She knew the mortgage banking industry inside and out. She was absolutely terrified, and she was scared because they were all the mortgage industry was pulling back on the risk management side.
And there's money to be made.
Yeah,
we'll worry about risk later.
Oh yeah, the whole industry changed. They went away from the 3 C's, where you're looking at credit and collateral and capacity to pay, and we just went to FICO scores.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Bill McBride. He is the founder and proprietor of the highly rated Calculated Risk Economics blog, well regarded by many people. You don't have a PhD in economics. You have an MBA. How did you go from essentially a medical devices company founder to one of the leading lights in financial economics writing?
Well, I don't know if I'm a leading light, but it's very nice all those things people have said about me. But I've always had an interest in economics. I've always had an interest in housing. I study hard. I dig hard to try to understand the data, I've worked with a lot of economists since I started the blog. A lot of academic economists that I call friends now.
Give us some names.
Jim Hamilton down in San Diego.
Fantastic.
Yeah, Mark Tama up in Oregon.
Another one. Terrific. Yeah,
Tim Dewey.
Sure.
So
you're just named my starting lineup of economists, right?
Yeah, there. Yeah. I mean, so those guys I chat with. I chat with several of them all the time. Mm-hmm. It helps me focus on what's important in economics and how to understand it, and I think they like that I really dig through the data, so it's kind of a mutual thing.
So let's talk a little bit about the state of the U.S. economy. I'm going to throw some things out that I hear and see and read online that I question pretty significantly, and I want to just get your feedback on each of these. The recession never ended. The economy is still spiraling downward, and we're going into a depression.
No, that's unrealistic, obviously. Employment is up substantially since 2009. Mm-hmm. The economy is growing slowly from a GDP perspective. Mm-hmm. That's driven, in my view, by two main things. One is, for some reason, productivity's down, something that I don't think anybody can really control, at least measure productivity.
Right.
But also, and a key thing that's very rarely mentioned is demographics. We've the prime working age population started decreasing. Not workforce, but population in about 2010, mm-hmm. and decreased for 5 or 6 years, and that's because of all the baby boomers.
So if you were born in the 50s or 60s,
yeah.
So let's say you're born in 1950, that would make you 66 today. You're thinking about retiring.
Right, and you're out of the prime working age. You know, as you get past 60, which I can say happens, you have less energy. Mm-hmm. You know, so
you're, are you speaking personally?
No, I'm talking about myself.
Okay.
So you know, when you get a little older, you know, now I'm still doing things, but I don't think I'm as excited about spending a lot of hours a day working.
But you do spend a decent amount of time working.
I spend a decent amount. Nothing like what I was spending in 2009, but that's not age related. That's just
crisis related.
Right. Yeah,
you got to be doing 2-4 hours a day.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Right. At least
you're what my wife describes as gainfully unemployed. Right. It's like you would be doing this whether there was money in it or not. And is there money in it? That's a question that people ask.
Well,
is there money in blogging?
Well, first of all, when I started the blog, I didn't take any advertising for mm-hmm. 2 or 3 years. I didn't even think about it. So,
right. So
it really was just a hobby.
Uh-huh.
People said, hey, take advertising. And so I eventually did. There's not a whole lot of money in it,
mm-hmm.
but you know, it pays for some nice dinners out.
There you go.
Yeah.
So it's still more or less a hobby that keeps you active.
Yes. You know, I guess I have this thing. I promised my readers that I would call or try to call the next recession.
Mm-hmm.
I said,
and you've been pretty consistent saying we're nowhere near a recession anytime.
Yeah, so I hope to hang around long enough to do that. And I don't see one in the near term at all, so I guess I'm going to be around for a while.
Let's look at the indicators that you track in order to identify a recession. And you track everything from rail car waitings to ships coming into the LA port. It's not just GDP employment. You look at a ton of stuff. What are some of your favorite indicators to look at?
Well, to me, the housing, new home sales, housing starts, I always start there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, employment, of course, is the big dog. So,
right.
So, I mean, if employment went negative for several months in a row, I would really be...
Now, I heard from some political candidate that all of the employment data is fake.
Well, I don't think there's probably a better organization than the BLS as far as telling us, being transparent on how they do their work.
They publicly announce all the changes. It's always academically driven.
You can go to their website. You can understand exactly what they do, what they don't do, mm-hmm. and how any changes, which have been minor over the years, in how they gather data. So they're completely transparent.
And can call them up and ask them questions.
Oh yeah, and they're very helpful. So the it's possible to disagree that, there's a different way to measure it, but to say that they're doing it fake is outrageous.
And outrageous.
Yeah.
There was, what, 3,000 statisticians, PhDs, economists, et cetera. Could you really fake something and not have that leak out somewhere? They're not all from one party or the other. It seems like an impossible claim.
It is. It is impossible. And there are... independent ways to measure some of that,
mm-hmm.
and it looks good too. You know, whether you look at ADP employment, which is a private measure,
right? They're in on it also. They're part of the
conspiracy.
Right,
yeah,
right.
That's always
the answer you get.
Those numbers are very, very good, do they describe everything? No.
The model isn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination.
But the methodology is transparent, so you can go in and it's the same as like new home sales or housing starts. You can go and see what they count, what they don't count, you know, how they add mm-hmm. them in. That was very important during the crisis because you had to see like a new home sales how they canceled.
Right.
You know, they handled
canceled contract was a whole separate.
Yeah, and they handled it completely different than the public companies. So mm-hmm. and so you could kind of say, well, gee, you know, they're going to catch up on this and they're following. And,
right.
And you know, the public companies basically have to. Here's what we got. They're reporting net sales.
Right.
Where the Census Bureau is tracking a house, and then if it gets canceled later, then they take it out. So but those sales that they originally reported is still there. Mm-hmm. It's important to understand that methodology. Right now, that's irrelevant because everything's tracking.
Right.
You know, the if you follow the home builders and you follow the new home sales, they're pretty much tracking.
So let's talk a little more about housing. My friend Jonathan Miller, who's a highly regarded appraiser and data assembly on housing, has been talking for a good couple of years about the problem with no equity and low equity homeowners, and it sort of gums up the chain of purchases. In other words, hey, we're in a starter home. Oh, we have a second kid on the way. Let's sell this house, move up to a four-bedroom. The people selling that house move up to a larger house, and those people move up to the big mansions, but as long as the people at the bottom starter home are kind of stuck there because they don't have enough equity, the whole system is sort of compromised, and it means that there just isn't enough supply out there. How does that sound?
That is a problem, and housing historically always has been this kind of chain reaction. One guy sells, then he can buy, and another sell and buy and sell and buy. And so the situation we're in today is pretty unique.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's rarely mentioned is that the reason there's such low inventory, especially at the lower ends, is because of all those investor buying.
Sure.
Millions and millions of homes.
Buy to rent, buy to fix and flip, to resell.
Yeah, the fix and flip doesn't hurt the market, but the
Buy to rent.
There's millions of homes that were bought to rent. And
at a huge discount right at the height of the crisis.
Yeah, and so those guys, I talked to some of those guys. And
private equity or individual investors or both?
It's a combination. Mm-hmm. You know, I know moms and pops that bought 6-8 places. I know some larger investors that bought thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, none of them are selling.
Really?
So
why is that?
Well, okay, if they sell, they have to play capital gains. And then
there's one sure way to make sure you never pay capital gains taxes, don't have a capital gain.
Yeah.
So that's always, to me, not a great reason not to sell.
Yeah, but
then where else are they going to put their money?
Well, then they have to move it to somewhere else, right?
Right.
And you know, what are you going to do? And those guys, rents have gone up substantially. They were buying these things with cap rates of 12-15% when they bought them, and the rents have gone up dramatically.
Right.
So on their original money, they're just cranking it. If they sell it, even if they can avoid paying capital gains, if they sell it and avoid capital gains, where do they put their money and get that same return?
You get 1.5% on the 10-year. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's not negative yet. It's a positive.
I know several people personally that own, you know, maybe 3 or 8.
They'd rather just get the income. And
they're never going to sell them.
We've been speaking with Bill McBride. He is the founder and chief blogger at Calculated Risk. Be sure and check out the site Calculated Risk for just an incredible slew of economic data, charts, and analysis. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out our podcast Extras, where we keep the digital tape rolling and continue to discuss all things economic and digital. Check out my daily column on BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. We love your emails and comments. Please write to us at MIBpodcast@bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome to the podcast. This is Barry Ritholtz. Bill, thank you so much for doing this. You know,
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You and I have been writing each other, no exaggeration, it's got to be 10, 12 years.
Yes.
I think we had dinner this week. I think that's the first time we met in person. Is that right?
That's correct.
So I have tons of stories and anecdotes. There's so many questions to get through. And before I get to my standard questions, there's just so much stuff I have to do. By the way, before we get to those questions, how are you enjoying your week in New York?
I'm having a great time.
The weather couldn't be nicer.
Oh, really, yeah. Thank you so much.
It was miserable, 90 and humid last week. It's been
perfect today. I went for a walk in the Central Park this morning.
It's been delightful. So you're now spending 2, 3, 4 hours a day blogging.
Yes.
In the midst of the crisis, 08, 09, how much time were you devoting to the site?
I was probably spending maybe 8 hours a day.
A full day's work.
But I was up, you know, at 5 in the morning and doing work. And I was, you know, right before I went to bed, I was doing work.
Right. And it's not 9 to 5. It's
all day.
It's digital hours.
Right. 16, 17 hours a day. I did sleep a little.
Right.
And every once in a while, I'd have to set my alarm clock for the middle of the night because I knew something crazy was coming.
Really? So you would wake up to see data?
Oh, especially when stuff was coming from Europe.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'd be going, oh, great.
See, my attitude is always, well, it'll be there in the
morning. Yes.
It'll be there in the morning.
And that's my attitude now.
When did you realize that the site was really catching on?
You know, it kind of just built.
It's a boiled frog,
yeah,
right?
It happened over time. You know, it was interesting because at first, I'd say the first month, because you see the traffic data, you know, right. I was just sending it to friends and relatives. All those posts now have lots of hits, but that's because people have gone back in time.
Years later.
You know, maybe in February 2005, Dr. David Altegg of
sure.
Cleveland Fed,
yes,
or Atlanta Fed now, I guess, he stumbled on my blog somehow,
mm-hmm.
and he mentioned something that I had written, and all of a sudden, my traffic was, you know, 100 readers a day out right. of the blue.
100 readers a day.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I went, wow, what happened there? And then something interesting happened is one of those readers was one of the three PhD economists at Angry Bear. And he called me up and said, hey, could you write a weekly column about housing? Because I was completely focused on housing at the time.
Uh-huh.
And so I wrote that.
With good reason.
Yeah. I wrote that. And within several months, I was up to 2,000 readers a day.
Right. And, you know? And what was the peak traffic in 08, 09?
Yeah. Probably averaged throughout 08 and 09, probably 120,000 readers a day.
What does it work out to be on a monthly basis?
I was probably 4 million, 3-4 million
readers. Yeah. It went crazy.
It was crazy. It was crazy. Yeah.
And then it cut in half after that.
Yeah, I'm probably 40% of that now.
Right.
You know, maybe 40,000 readers a day. So.
But these are 40,000 important, influential readers.
Yeah. Well, they're obviously people that are very interested in economics.
And we talked a little bit during the broadcast portion about comments. How frustrating is it that comments was once so crucial, so seminal, and now they're just a wreck?
Well, you know,
I don't mean your comments.
Well,
I mean
our comments. Since you have to register, they're okay, but they're more clicky, and they're long term people who just talk about off topic subjects.
Clicky, not with a Q, not
yes,
web clicky.
Yes, yes.
Like it's groups of people chatting.
Yeah, yeah. They have their topics they want to talk about. It's unrelated. It's completely different. When in 2005, 2006, when I would post something, the topics were on topic. I mean, the comments were on topic.
Insightful.
Yeah, and that's
relevant.
Where I met a lot of great people, including my co-blogger. I was talking about this a little bit earlier. I remember using Yahoo Finance when it first came out.
That's right.
You'd comment on a company, and the comments are great. It didn't take long, since they were all public, for that just to go completely downhill and be completely useless.
In the 90s, I very vividly, so I began as a trader in the mid-90s, and I very vividly remember stumbling into Yahoo comments, and a family member had this huge position in iOmega. It had split 2-for-1, 3-for-1, 2-for-1. What started out as a $10,000 investment was like a $3 million holding. And I remember following the iOmega Yahoo message boards with people driving. I think the factory was in Utah or some crazy thing.
Yeah.
Driving by the factory on a Sunday, and all of Wall Street is underestimating the revenue and profit numbers. Hey, the factory parking lot is filled with cars on a Sunday night. These guys are working double and triple shifts. Like, it was that sort of serious investigation.
It was awesome. You get that kind of local color. Somebody knew something about the company. Not insider information. Driving by a company.
No,
not
just the parking lot.
Yeah,
just,
somebody
hey, that's public, man.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So
yeah, and you know, the only, you could get a little bit of that on Twitter now. And somebody might take a picture of the parking lot. Of course, then you don't really know if it's real or not.
That's become, and there's been a lot of scams and hacks and things. You really have to be careful with what you see. You know, I've talked about this very, very little. I wrote Bailout Nation with my commenters. I would post a 300-word or 400-word thing in the evening that I had written during the day. What do you think about this? Tell me your thoughts. And people would say, have you seen this article in the Christian Science Monitor? Have you know? Because obviously the front page of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, everybody sees. So you have this huge research team and people making suggestions and comments. The golden age of blog comments was unlike anything the media had ever seen.
You know, it's funny because one of my commenters wrote a fiction book partially in the comments called American Apocalypse. He's a lawyer. Unfortunately, he has passed away now. But it became a pretty good seller on Amazon.
Really?
And he wrote it in the comments, and people would... It was a fiction thing about, you know, if the financial crisis had really gotten bad.
Right.
Total second Great Depression or worse. And but you know, it's just kind of like you and Bailout Nation, except for he started it in the comments, and it was fun. It was kind of fun to
read
along.
That's amazing. Have you ever gotten invites to speak or take a meeting with anybody from Treasury Department, Federal Reserve, House Joint Economics Committee, anything along those lines?
Nothing. Well, the Treasury invited me back once,
mm-hmm.
But that was it.
When you say invited you back,
they if I came, I got to you know, meet some senior people,
mm-hmm.
but I was in California, so it wasn't very convenient for me.
I got the Tim Geithner invite, which I think was a public relations thing.
Yes. Did you go to that?
No.
See, that's the one I was talking about.
And did you go to that?
No. I was in California. It's too far.
I was in New York. It was too far because it just smelled like one of those things. Come on in. He'll come in, shake some hands, do a photo op. And why did I travel 3 hours each way for this? I politely responded and said, hey, let me know the next time Tim is in New York. I'm happy to meet with him, but I'm not interested in a photo op. And that was the sort of outreach trip. Oh, these bloggers are causing us trouble. Did you ever get a sense that you were causing trouble to elected officials?
No, I never.
Not at all.
I never felt that at all. There was a time, I think there was a lot of resentment from the media about blogging.
Let's talk about that. I used to do this thing, and I know Tanta did something similar, called Read It Here First. In the beginning, I launched The Big Picture in 2003, but before that it was a Yahoo GeoCities site, and after 9/11, I had written a piece that kind of had gone viral. So it's like, oh, this internet thing is going to be big one day. And so I would notice the amazing coincidence. You'd write about something, and then a day or a week later, it would show up in Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Barron's, Business, everywhere, whole media.
Yes.
And my initial, no one would just steal this. I must have picked something up, and other people from whatever motivated me to write this, so they must have been motivated by the same thing. I don't want to say it was in the ether, but if I'm looking at an economic news release and Bill is looking at an economic news release and a reporter at XYZ paper is looking at that, we're all looking at the same thing. And I assumed it was a coincidence. And that changed in 2004. I wrote a long-form piece called Radio's Wounded Business Model that basically trashed Clear Channel Communications and it trashed Infinity Broadcasting. It was really just a rant. And maybe it was 3 weeks later, Barron's has a cover story. And I'm a music buff and I hate program radio. This wasn't motivated by anything out there. This was just me going on a jag. And then Barron's has a cover story called Losing the Signal. And it was practically a point-by-point thing. And that was a moment where it dawned on me that, hey, it's not in the ether. These people are ripping you off. What Tanta did something.
Well,
tell us what she did with a similar bit of thievery.
Well, you know, I was working with a lot of reporters on their stories.
Mm-hmm. And you were anonymous back then,
yeah,
right?
I would help, people would call me up. And we would chat about a story, possible angles, ways to write it, and every time they would go, my editor will not let me mention that you're writing a blog calculator risk. can I mention that you used to be the executive of this company, use your real name? I said, no. You know, if you can't, I'll help you on stories all you want. That's there, and that goodwill over time paid off. But you know, I said, no, I just want to stay anonymous. I didn't know why at the time, but it was just kind of fun for me.
Right.
And
you were retired. You weren't looking
I wasn't trying to make any money. I wasn't trying to start a war. Tanta, when she came on, she used to call me up.
And she furious.
She'd go, Bill, they ripped off your story, or they ripped off my story. And so then she wrote a piece about how, you know, if you want to use our information, boy, you really should mention that where you got it from. That's just kind of standard practice in journalism.
Stop stealing.
Yeah. And several journalism professors have told me they use her piece they teach it in their classes.
That's great.
At colleges. And it was immediately after that we started getting mentioned everywhere. And, you know, a lot of the reporters I know wanted to mention us
right.
much sooner.
So it was editorial and publishing, not the actual writer.
Yes, the writer.
Listen, writers, I write a daily column. It's drummed into your head from day one. Always source, always link, always quote, always footnote.
Right.
Don't just take. And my nightmare is reading something and kind of subconsciously ferreting it away, and then it comes out and it's like, oh, I ripped someone off by accident. That's my nightmare scenario.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's always hard for a writer. I try to be very, very careful and link to everything
So what I started doing after the Barron's piece, that to me was clearly, oh, this isn't even nuanced. This is just blatant. So I started a series of Read It Here First columns, and I would do side by side the two columns.
Oh, yeah.
I'd highlight stuff. I'd put on the blog. And especially with the outlets that included the author and editors, I never had that from Bloomberg, and I'm not just saying that because I'm here, but I've had it from because their sources, they have a really crazy strict sourcing mechanism. But a lot of other places, I would take the two pieces, say, what a coincidence, I wrote this on Monday, you published this on Tuesday, I would send it to the reporter, I would send it to the editor, and I would sort of politely on the blog say, read it here first. And eventually, I think they became embarrassed. So like 04, 05, 06.
Yeah.
Once you got into 07 and 08, and I was, you know, I had an official job title where I was a market strategist and a media spokesperson. So it was easy for me to say, hey, you don't have to quote the blog, but at least credit the source. You don't even have to link to it, but, you know, you're stealing my work product.
Well, you know, the media would mention people like Professor Jim Hamilton in San Diego or Mark Tama. But they'd always mention that, oh, Mark Thomas, a professor at University of Oregon.
Right. It was an official title.
Yeah, not that he's writing a site called The Economist View, right. Which had the information, you know. So you know, that's what they were comfortable doing, but not the referencing the blogs. It took a different, but they shifted, and they...
Sure. Well, first they rolled out their own blogs.
Yeah, and then they realized that it's all complimentary anyway.
Right.
In fact, we would drive traffic for them.
Mm-hmm.
We'd mention that, oh, hey, wait, they, you know, this guy had a good thing about this, and people would go read that traffic. And it got to the point where journalists would send me their articles and say, hey, if you like this, could you mention it or link to it? Or
because their editors were saying, hey, get some blog mentions.
Yeah, and it really helped them.
When did that flip take? When did it go from, ooh, blogs we could steal with impunity and no one will know?
It had to be in 2007.
Right.
2007.
That's when you first started noticing people asking.
Yeah, and all of a sudden we were, and it really boosted our traffic too.
Did you ever get deluged with PR pitches? Hey, would you like to meet the executive sales?
Well, you get that every day.
You do?
Yes. Every day.
I relentlessly blacklist the people that just send ridiculous. It's one thing that it's unsolicited. But I don't really care about this 16-year-old girl's new pop song. That's not relevant to what we're writing
about.
Yeah,
well, you know, I think I saw the other day there's more PR people now than there are journalists in America.
Is that
true? By 2-1 or something.
That explains a whole lot. Oh, my God, that's awful. That is a horrible, horrible thought. on the terminal, you have this option. On the Bloomberg terminal, you have this option. So every now and then, a reasonable PR pitch comes in, or a reader will say, so I had Jeff Maggioncalda, who is the founder and former CEO of Financial Engines, which they work with Nobel laureate Bill Sharp, and they were really one of the first entities out there to do what people are calling robo-advising today. But it was Bill Sharp and an entire way to manage 401ks through a series of intelligent algorithms. And they run like $100+ billion. So someone who worked for the company sends an email. Love the podcast. Are you familiar with Maggioncalda and Financial Engines? No, I never even heard of them. They're a public company, this and that. So I look them up. I'm like, how have I never heard about these guys? They are all rock stars. So that sort of pitch from somebody,
yeah,
that's fantastic.
It's a relevant pitch, and it's yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and that wasn't even a PR person. I think it was it Cory Doctorow at Boing Boing said he published a whole list of all these PR shops email you. And you blacklist the PR shop. So now you're getting these pitches from Gmail. So he went out and published, I think it was him, I hope I'm not getting the wrong person, a list of everybody on this list is a PR wanker who is using Gmail.
But they're multiplying so fast, you can never keep up.
So here's a list, add them to your blacklist, and you won't ever see anything from that. And I just read that Apple and Google are now doing something similar on the phone side. It's amazing how this I'm so far, I've digressed so far. Let me jump back to some of the questions that we just didn't get a chance to discuss. You mentioned you're were publishing anonymously. What made you decide to come out from behind the cloak of anonymity?
Well, first I started that way just because I thought that's how you did it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just, calculate a risk. I thought it was fun.
Right.
You know, people don't need to know who I am. The people who I originally sent it to knew who I was.
Right.
The when Tanta came on board, Tanta was very concerned. She was very, obviously very hopeful that she would recover.
So she wanted to maintain
And she was very concerned that if she said certain things, she may never get another job.
Right.
And actually, people in the industry knew who she was.
Immediately.
Yeah. There's only so many people that could be writing what she wrote.
Right.
And then there very few of those were women. Then as long as she wanted to stay anonymous, I stayed anonymous too. I didn't want pressure on her.
Right.
And so... the first time my name actually came out was in the obituary in the New York Times.
Really?
For Tanta.
No kidding.
That was the first time. I believe that was the first time my name came out. And then after that, my name's in the open, so I went ahead and just started saying, yeah, that's me.
And that was pretty much...
Because they quoted me in the New York Times talking about Tanta.
I can imagine.
And obviously, they had her real name in that article, too.
So I posted on the blog, Ask Calculator Risk Anything. Here's a little blast for the from the past.
Oh, yeah. Look at that.
I pulled the old header from the Blogspot days.
Oh, yeah.
I like
that picture.
I love that picture. I always like that picture. The path right down the middle between the trees.
I took that up in Canada.
Mm-hmm. That's really so you guys can see that on the big picture. So the anonymity just kind of ended.
It ended when Tanta passed away.
It wasn't a conscious decision.
As soon as she passed away, my name was in public anyway. I obviously linked to the New York Times obituary article.
Which was actually a lovely, lovely piece.
They wrote a beautiful piece, and I think this is probably the first time anyone got an obituary for being a blogger. She was so famous.
I think that might very well be the case. So let's talk about a related issue. What is the war on data?
Oh, I wrote a piece, I don't know, last month or whenever that was.
Mm-hmm. I bookmarked it and saved it knowing this was coming up. By the way, for listeners, Bill lives on the other side, literally about as far away in mainland United States. You're in Newport Beach?
Right.
And... we knew you were coming in 5 months ago, 4 months ago. So I started saving stuff. Oh, let me ask him about this. That one has been with me for a while. So let's jump into it. What is the war on data?
Well, we were talking about a little bit earlier. There's a sense that the data's false by a certain group of people.
Not just the employment data,
but they you know, I'd have to go back through my piece, but I forget all the things I was pulling out.
It's political, some of it's with people with positions. Market positions or housing positions.
Yeah, there are a group of people. It's just like people that reject climate change, if you will. You know,
Wait, are you saying climate change is real? Now I gotta go. I gotta go rethink everything.
But you know, there are people that are rejecting data and going with what they want it to be.
Sure.
They want the data to be this for whatever reason, whether it's political or
cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
I think some percentage of these folks don't even realize what they're doing. Some are just outright lying, but there is a healthy percentage that simply can't acknowledge reality.
Well, they see their own circumstances and maybe believe that that's more widespread.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe for whatever reason they're seeing more inflation than the inflation data shows, and because of how they spend their money.
Sure.
You know, no question, rent's gone up faster than inflation. So if rent's a big portion of somebody's monthly spending, they're going to think, well, those inflation numbers are incorrect. So, you know, there's some of that. It's just that I think people are taking that, people in positions of some power are taking that, and or commentators, and they're just attacking data right and left. And, you know, if like we were talking earlier, you have to have a good system of collecting data, and you have to be transparent on the data.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have. The United States probably has the best data in the world by far.
Who's even close? There's no one even second.
Well, Western Europe is far behind us. And
dinner last night, a reporter who is hometown in London was saying the UK has terrible data compared to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, they're actually very good. In the world. The United States is just excellent.
Right. We started post-recession, post-Great Depression in the 30s and 40s. This really came about from a number of people where it was pretty clear there was no data to measure progress or lack thereof.
Well, you know, that anytime you have something that you want to understand, first thing you have to do is measure it. Because then if you say you make a policy change, well, how do you know if it did anything if you can't measure it? It's like you know, losing weight or something. If you don't get on the scale, how do you know if you've really lost weight? I guess you could check
how
your belt.
Well,
that's
pants,
yeah. But that's another measurement system.
I guess it is.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes, after the Great Depression, they started collecting much better employment data. I was kind of hoping after the Great Recession that there would be an emphasis on collecting better housing data. I think they could improve the housing data.
In what way? So let's go over some of the housing stats. So you have the existing home sales, which is reported by the National Association of Realtors. You have new home sales, which is
Census Bureau,
which is sort of kind of self-reported by the builders themselves.
Well, independently. So.
Independently. And I recall writing something that you want to take a 3-month average. Anytime you have an outlier to the upside or downside,
like today,
it invariably reverses the fear.
Yeah,
that's right. We had a huge upside.
Oh yeah, yeah. I would say, hey, it's great. It's a great, great number. I wouldn't say
look
that.
For mean reversion.
Yeah, yeah.
If you go back and look at the data, you can always spot the outlier and the month the following. Because what ends up happening is people.
Well, they'll revise that down.
Sure, and the whatever follows it will be a terrible month. And that'll eventually get revised up and
that's one of the reasons I do graphs anyway, is because it kind of can show you where you're at. Yeah, this will be a little spike up and
but it's within the range of variability.
It's fine. We're getting there anyway. It's only 650,000. That's not even that big of a number historically.
So that's right. So we have new home sales. We have existing home sales. We have contract signings. We have permits for building.
Well, housing starts is a very important number.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
That's one of the biggest impacts on the economy is how many from the housing industry,
as opposed to existing home sales.
Well,
where
existing home sales is just
there's
the
mortgage,
broker fee,
swap keys. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, that's the yes. that people do frequently buy a little more furniture
durable
or something.
Durable goods, right.
But it's more from the direct sale, that's all it is the broker's fee and a few other fees.
Right, mortgages.
That adds
blah, blah,
to the economy.
Right.
But when you build a new home sales, the whole price is new. It's that you've added to the existing wealth of the country. So it's a big deal.
And what's the ratio of existing to new home sales, more or less?
It's about 8 to 1.
That's about right.
Maybe 10 to 1 even. Mm-hmm. It used to be closer, maybe 6 to 1 existing to the new. There's been ever since the crisis, a lot more existing home sales. New homes got slaughtered.
Well, because you're competing against
with foreclosures,
right?
Yeah.
You're competing against dramatically. Although, let's talk a little bit about foreclosures. And before I get to foreclosures, I almost forgot. Multifamily homes, that's been a big uptick post-crisis also.
Yes.
And is that just a reflection of rental demand or?
One of the nice things about for multifamily is there's the demographics have been incredibly positive for them. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you had all these people moving out of foreclosed homes and looking for a place to rent. Now, a lot of those houses were bought to rent. Mm-hmm. And so that you would think, you wouldn't have this multifamily, but you do have this huge surge in people in the 20s. And that's the main rental demographic. So there's a big cohort there. They're not going to buy. They're starting to move into the buying years. So
right.
They're
moving out of parents' basement. They're certainly renting. Are they forming households? That's another great data
point. Yeah, and they will.
Household formation.
And they will. The problem with household formation data, see, there's an area that we could really improve. Mm-hmm. Is everybody uses the HVS, Housing Vacancy Survey or whatever.
Right.
And that data is not consistent with the annual census or the 10-year census. So the Census Bureau is aware of that, and they're trying to figure out why that data is so inconsistent. But that's something they could do a much better job of, I think, is household formation.
So the next president gets elected and they say, I want to see some better data on the economic side. And they pick up the phone and say, Bill, you mind coming to D.C. for a year or two? We have some work for you. What sort of stuff would you look to add, refine, improve, or eliminate?
Well, I think housing is so important that I would definitely go through the methodology of each of those. One of the interesting things, I think, is for housing starts, if I'm remembering this correctly, it might be new home sales. Mm-hmm. They don't include certain condos.
Right.
So if they're side-by-side condos, they include them, but if they're high-rise condos, they don't. And it's really complicated.
Right.
And we're moving to where there's more of those being built. So we could have more units coming on the market than anybody's really aware.
So that has to be fixed.
Yeah, that just needs to be resolved.
What aren't we measuring that we should?
Well, you know, I'm not completely confident in the private sources of data. So
let's talk about the National Association of Realtors, and I'll throw them under the bus because I know you don't want to do that. Everybody who blogged about real estate and economics used to make fun of the chief economists for the NAR because they were from the peak in 06 to the bottom in 2010. They were just relentlessly optimistic. And
I forget that guy's name, David.
David Yun.
Oh, that's the current guy. Right?
Luria.
Yeah, that's him.
So he had the same book.
He wrote a book in 2006.
So the fantastic thing about that book is the same book came out 2 or 3 times. Same picture, same everything. There's a blog post somewhere about it. And they just changed the name of it. So the first name was something like, I'll Google it and see if I can find it. Why now is the time to buy housing? It was right at the peak. And then 2 years later, they reissued it with a different housing. Take advantage of the decline in housing. And then the third cover was, we're all going to die, run for the hills sort of thing.
Well, you know,
and by the way, that was at the bottom. It was quite amazing.
Well, you know, when we're talking about the NAR, I have a good relationship with a lot of the industry people at MBA, Mortgage Bankers Association.
Which I find to be a much more realistic
group. Oh, those guys are straight shooters, and they do an excellent job. National Association of Home Builders, same thing. The NAR, for some reason, they're more cheerleader-oriented.
Because it's real estate agents, and...
Here
it is. I actually found it.
Oh.
The 05, David Luria, Are You Missing the Real Estate Boom? And then the second version of the cover in 2006 was Why the Real Estate Boom Will Not Bust. And then the 2007, and by the way, there's a house floating and a couple with a kid looking at it in the first two editions. The third edition, all real estate is local. The house is missing. It's just a street.
That's great.
and that is actually, this is not fabricated. This is true. It's the same book, could not have been more wrong. With three different covers, it's quite astonishing.
Well, but their role is a cheerleader,
right?
National Association of Home Builders, their role, the home builders really want to know what's happening, and so when they gather data from them and distribute it, it's real. And mm-hmm. same with Mortgage Bankers Association. I'm not saying the NAR's data isn't real. They just spin it very positively, and it's not really gathered in a very scientific way. So
so isn't it based on whatchamacallit? On actual closings, don't they?
Yeah, but they're sampling.
You think it's mushy?
Yeah, they sample. What they do is they sample certain large multiple listing services. And that's they based it off that, and then what they were doing is every 10 years they would go to the Census Bureau, and look at how many houses it sold, and then they would try to
rejigger it,
yeah, if you will.
So
to me, we're getting to the stage where why can't we count pretty much every closing in America?
I don't understand why not either.
Yeah, I know that's been discussed.
When you're in D.C., can we get the BLS or? Commerce Department to
yeah,
take
I'd,
over
I'd like,
reporters.
I'd like to see them do that. And you know, the other thing is when they're calculating GDP, they're just estimating the percentage that the salesperson gets.
Which has been under pressure, and shrinking.
Yeah, and I think that, it's very possible that that's being overstated a little bit.
So we really
Who knows? I really don't know. Nobody knows, and there's a lot of estimating that goes on, but that whole industry is undergoing dramatic change right now,
for sure,
and the online sites have just changed it dramatically. So they could measure that a lot better, and so we've talked about how they could they might be missing some high rise condos. Existing home sales and commissions I think could be measured a lot better. House prices I think is an interesting thing. The FHFA it does an excellent job. And they have an expanded series. It doesn't get the publicity it deserves.
Are they tracking the same house over time?
Yes, exactly.
That's what's really fascinating.
It's a repeat sales. But even that, is right away.
What, 7 years apart on average, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Even that has obvious flaws. What if the people didn't maintain it? What if they put in a new kitchen?
Right, right.
Just
put in a new bathroom.
Yeah, they try to do some permitting. It was something permitted, but a lot of people put in a new bathroom without permitting it, and so.
In my town of Oyster Bay, unless you're changing the footprint of the house or running a natural gas line in, like I'm in the midst of doing, you don't need a permit. You need a permit for the natural gas. You could redo a kitchen. You could redo a bathroom. You don't need a permit. If you extend the house, if you change the footprint, if you make a deck bigger and it impinges on the neighbor, you need a permit for that.
Well, it depends on what you do. Obviously, I think in any area you can retile your bathroom.
Sure.
Without a permit. I think if you move the electricity around,
yep.
Change the plugs, whatever, I think most places would require a permit.
Makes sense.
You have to have the electrical inspected to make sure mm-hmm. it was done to code.
To code,
yeah.
Absolutely.
So, but a lot of people do that without permits.
So there's, of course, you don't want to pay an increased tax rate. You pay a fine at the end 5 years later.
Yeah.
So instead of paying $1,000 more a year, you pay a $250.
Well, they never even catch them. So.
Sometimes you need a CO, a certificate of occupancy, when you do the sale. So people run around before a closing in order to make all that. On the spin from the National Association of Realtors, I'm going way back. 2007, there was a quote in the Palm Beach Post Some realtors are grumbling about prices falling. Guess who they're not falling? Guess who they're blaming? A growing number of realtors in Florida are frustrated with the state and national realtors group efforts to spin the market as one that is strengthening and where home prices are stabilizing. Customers continue to list their homes at prices that are unrealistic, and as a result, sales volumes and thus commissions continue to be depressed. So the net impact of the NAR spin in 07 was that agents were saying to people, these prices are unrealistic, and they're saying, well, I read in the paper, things are getting better.
Yeah,
that's the problem. That's what the home builders don't tolerate, but the agents on a national level have messed with.
Yeah, you know, but there's more than the National Association of Realtors there.
They're complaining about state and national.
If you own a home and it's pretty much equivalent to your neighbor and he sold it for $600,000 and the agents tell you, well, you're only going to get $500,000 for yours, you think that agent's crazy. And yet that might have been a very fair price or maybe even too high.
How many times did you have that conversation with people? And they said, when did the neighbor sell the house? Well, they sold it in 05. Well, it's 08 and we have 5 million foreclosures going
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
Well, if you want to sell it at that price, get in a time machine, go back to 05, you get that price.
Yeah. It does take extra effort. You do have to explain that to them and go through. I do know a family member, my mom, who wanted to sell in like 2007 and moved to a retirement community. And it worked out great for her. But I went down, we went looked at the local houses, and the inventory was really expanding. And I said, let's underprice everybody.
Right.
And we sold it right away. And you know what? That guy's got a nice house, and it's worth more than he paid for it. He's fine, and he loves the house, but my mom got that money out. It made her retirement easy, you know. But other people were sticking to their prices, you know, or chasing them down, which is probably the worst thing you can do.
I did that with a house we tried to buy, and thanks to technology, you could look at every listing price. And then you find out, so it's here, and then it's 100,000 lower, and then it's 100,000 lower, and you're watching them, but they're 100,000 or more behind the market. So they're just following it down and not selling it and just creating this paper trail.
Well, chasing a market is one of the worst things you can do.
You got to skate to where the puck's going to be, not to where it was
exactly.
5 minutes ago.
Exactly.
And selling a house is so emotional. Hey, we lived here for 20 years. We raised our kids here. How could this only be worth X? It's worth 3X.
Right.
Well, to you, but you've already bought it. It's coming to somebody who doesn't have the memories. You got to get realistic. So we mentioned foreclosures before. Let's talk a little bit about the foreclosure crisis way back when. What took place during from the 06 peak to 2010, 2011 bottom, more or less? And what did we do right as a country, and what did we do wrong with that?
Oh, well, I personally think some areas of the country are still trying to recover.
So
New Jersey.
Right, but that has New Jersey has its own specific.
Yeah, if you go and look, the states that have been slowest to recover all have judicial foreclosure systems.
That's taken forever.
Yeah, and you know, about half the states are judicial. You got to go to court.
Right.
The other states, it's the straightforward system.
What about the rocket courts that Florida set up?
Yeah, I guess they've helped.
Supposed
some.
To be horrible, by the way.
Because
people have complained that they haven't even gotten notice. They've come home and...
Well, you know, it really didn't help. It made things obviously much, much worse for everybody that the mortgage industry was cheating on the foreclosures.
Constantly.
Yeah, and so...
Pam Bondi, AG of Attorney General of Florida, got elected and stopped with a lot of real estate developer and real estate owners' backings and stopped all the mortgage foreclosure cheating investigations that her office, her predecessor had run.
Yeah, well, that
not my favorite AG in America.
Yeah, but that, you know, to me that made things a much, much worse. If they had just followed the rules,
right,
and done things correctly.
What do you do when you can't find a note? We're missing the note. Now what?
Well, you can always go recreate it, though. I mean, they
but they were paying. There was actually a company.
It cost you a lot of money. That's one of the things that Tonta was talking about. They had cut the back rooms so much that they
right.
They just kind of assumed, well, we're never going to have foreclosures, you know. Whereas when Tonta was working in that industry, that was very important to check every file to make sure every file was completely correct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had every single piece of document, which is what they do again today.
So what about, let's talk a little bit about MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registry.
I like the idea. I think it's great.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I think that it's a scam, and it exists to not pay recording tax or transfer tax county by county. They've been sued by a number of people.
Well, yes, but
and it allows you to put... You could sell a mortgage so many times that supposedly you're tracking it through this electronic registry, but you weren't. There were so many times couldn't tell who owned the house.
Well, first of all,
who owned the note?
It was implemented poorly.
So terrible.
Once it's implemented poorly, it's a bad system.
Right.
So you don't. There's no argument for me on that. The general idea I kind of like.
Well, if it was done with full congressional authority and local authority, but that didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean the idea of that you. Because what they wanted to do was put the mortgages into mortgage-backed security.
Sure. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, it's nothing wrong with that.
But you can't have just some random company saying, in my opinion, we can't bypass the local authority because it's faster, easier, cheaper. I'm convinced that MERS is an underwritten story of the crisis.
Okay.
But for MERS, we may not have had as deep and bad a crisis. You couldn't have cranked out as many houses and
You needed that. Yeah.
So
that was you know, it was a little bit of a grease enabler, but it wasn't a cause. So
sure, no, definitely not a cause, but definitely an enabler. God, there's so many questions I haven't gotten to, and I want to make sure I leave some time to our standard questions. So here's an interesting question a reader had asked: Ask McBride what policy choices he would make to improve the lot of the bottom 50%, even if it hurt corporate America.
Well, I think that one of the key things is you got to have wages up. You have to get wages up for the lower income workers.
So how do we do that?
And so one thing you can do is you can mandate a higher minimum wage.
Right. Well, that'll help a ton. How many people earn minimum wage? It's
not that many, but it pushes up the people that are just above minimum wage.
Sure.
Too.
I guess everybody moves up slightly at the bottom.
It moves up. I think the key is more bargaining power for workers of some sort.
So that means stronger unions.
Yeah, well, we've crushed the unions.
Yes.
Other than the public unions, which have plenty of problems still, you know, I mean, because they have all these pensions that are crazy.
Right.
You know? So with the public unions, I'm kind of like, well, we should take a lot of effort and work on the pensions. But if when we're talking about improving the lot of the lower 50%, I think... getting some sort of bargaining for workers, whether they're unionized or some other way, I'm not a labor expert, but I do think that that's one of the keys.
The fall of it may be a coincidence, but the fall of the strength of unions and the fall in middle class income is seems to be quite the coincidence. One would imagine they're related.
Oh, they're definitely related. There's no question. And raising the minimum wage is going to help some. So, you know, there's a policy that we can do. I don't think that there's a big negative impact in most areas, especially in the coastal areas.
If you look in the Seattle and Portland and San Francisco and L.A., they could raise the minimum wage to $15, and it's fine.
Basically,
may not work in the heartland.
Yeah, basically in L.A. you have to pay that anyway.
Right.
So,
you see Walmart, McDonald's raising their minimum. That's telling you.
Yeah, they're having trouble getting workers.
Yeah. So it's you can either let the market do it or speed it along and do it legislatively. I know a lot of people hate mandate.
Yeah, I mean, working for the minimum wage is pretty minimal.
Right, and you're at $15, you're still at a 40-hour week. You're more or less right at the poverty level, depending on how many kids.
I don't know how you live in L.A. or New York.
You can't. It's impossible. You're taking a second job, working off the books. It's rough. Interesting question that came in from another reader. We keep hearing about quote the next subprime. Where do you see excesses in the credit market that might be the next subprime?
Right now, I think we're okay in most areas. A lot of people focus on the auto loans, but auto loans are the cars are easy to repossess.
The technology that's built into it now is you buy a car if you don't have a good credit rating. I wrote a column about this a few months ago, and they build in a remote kill switch. So you miss a payment, they shut the car off.
Yeah, and people.
You want that car? You got to wire the money in.
Yeah, in L.A. you want your car bad.
For sure.
That's how you get to work or get to anything. So, people pay. During the foreclosure crisis, people were paying their car loans, but they weren't paying their house loans.
The story was you'd pay your Visa, you'd pay your car loan, you would skip the student loan, you would skip the mortgage. Because are they going to do? It's going to take 3 years.
Yeah,
I'm not
that concerned about student loans either. I think that there's things we can do. Lower interest rates.
For sure.
I when I went to school, it really dates me, but I went to University of California, Irvine, paid $200 a quarter to go to school.
I went to SUNY Stony Brook. My first semester was not even quarter, two semesters a year, $450.
Yeah. So, I could go, I paid my way through school. I could work on the weekends.
Right.
Pay my rent, pay my tuition. I think that that's kind of
weird. Now it's $12,000 a semester. What do you do?
Yeah, if you can't work on the weekends to go to school, it makes life completely different.
Sure.
Not everybody did that. Luckily, a lot of people when I was young, their parents paid it because it wasn't that much either.
Right.
There's. I do like the idea of making some education less expensive.
Makes sense. What asset classes do you see as expensive or? Is that something you really don't pay close attention to?
I know it's not something I don't write about, but basically everything is at least fairly valued now. I don't see, like in 2012, it was clear to me that if you should be out buying as much real estate as you could. In 2009, you should be jumping in as hard as you can into the stock market.
Right.
So
what do you do in 2016?
Earlier this year, I put some money into the stock market when we had that nice
sell-off. We're at record highs here.
Yeah. And so that was, luckily I'm not sitting on any cash right now. I don't know exactly what I would do today. It's funny. One of the things is I don't know what I'm going to do until I need to do it exactly. Mm-hmm. I like that I don't give advice on investing.
On a daily basis.
Back when, because we were talking about the commenting, and I participated in this site called Silicon Investor for a little while.
Uh-huh.
And
they came to fame in the late 90s, screaming bubble, and they were right eventually, but getting the timing on that is really challenging.
But we would talk with some, as happens on every commenting thing. At first, it was really good, and we talk about different stocks. One of the things I discovered at the time is I could mention 10 stocks that I thought were good, and 9 of them would do great, and 1 of them would really underperform. And then every time I would say anything, people come back, weren't you the one who liked XYZ?
Yes, out of the 10 stocks I mentioned, XYZ.
Yeah, and after a while, you go, I'm tired of this. Let's chase away all the good commenters and just get it to the point where it's just garbage, and that's what they did.
The nice thing about you have an MBA, the nice thing about law school is you learn the rules of rhetoric and debate. And so I can very quickly identify that's a straw man argument, that's an ad hominem attack, that's arguing from extreme, you start to notice all the and comments are just...
They're all that.
It's just a place where logic and reasoning go to die. It's unfortunate. So last question before I get to my standard questions I ask everybody. So you said you don't see a recession anytime soon, and I never ask people for what's your favorite stock, where's the market could be, what's your forecast. So I'm reluctant to ask this as a forecasting question, but how long? So I'm going to phrase it slightly differently. How long do you see this economic expansion continuing? Is this something that could go on for 18, 24, 36 months, or are we closer to the end of the cycle than we are to the beginning?
Oh, I would say we're probably closer to the end than the beginning because we've been, this is
7 years.
7 years. Will it go another 7 years? It could, actually, because of the slow growth. Right. I don't think that's going to happen.
The ongoing deleveraging, it's ultra low rates.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, you look around and look at mortgage equity withdrawal. It's still basically zero. You know, people aren't.
Really?
Yeah. People.
We used to look at that data point. It was
enormously, you know, people were pouring money out of their houses.
Unbelievable.
I think we're right at that starting to turn positive again. But that can go a long time positive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the economy. So, as far as the cycle, I think we're mid-cycle somewhere, maybe late mid-cycle. I'm of that camp. Mm-hmm. Sixth inning.
I hate that metaphor.
But I'm over the camp that the recoveries don't, expansions don't die of old age. They right. die for other reasons. And so we need to see some real excesses. You know, some people, it's easy to point out excesses or imagined excesses. You could say, well, look at the bond market. The bond yields are so low. Clearly that's going to blow up someday.
Been hearing that for 7-8 years.
Yeah, but I'm not in that camp. I think that we're not seeing the excesses yet. We're not seeing the inflation that the Fed really would need to fight. I think that's going to be slow to come. The demographics is improving in the U.S., you know, forget about the baby boomers; they're moving on. But we're getting that nice group in the 20s, early 30s,
Gen X, Gen Y,
millennials, and you know, there could be a little bit more inflation as they compete for products. But you know, I don't see it picking up dramatically like we saw in the 70s at all.
All right, so let's jump into my standard questions. You already told us about your background. Who are your early mentors?
As far as economics?
As far as anything.
Oh. I was very fortunate to have some very good CEOs that I worked with. Don Judson at Vitalcom. Uh-huh. He was an absolute brilliant guy. I was kind of the number two guy there for a number of years. You know, he just would see things. And so he was great. Don Barry, the two Dons, was at the telecommunications company. He was the founder of that, and just another brilliant, positive person, you know, who just was a hard worker. Both those guys really promoted my career. Those two guys I owe a lot to.
The two Dons.
Yeah, the two Dons.
How about investors? Any particular investor influence your approach to investing, be it real estate, stocks, whatever?
Some Warren Buffett.
So, can't go wrong with that.
Yeah. So,
you could do worse.
Yeah. On real estate, you know, a little bit my dad.
Uh-huh.
You know,
that's nice.
My dad's still around. He's 94.
So he got to see the blog blow up. He got to all of your post-career success. He must have appreciated that.
It's funny because
must have tickled him.
It's the only thing he ever really understood that I did.
Really?
he'd come and look at the heart monitors and go, what the heck is this all about?
That's hilarious.
You know? But you know, when I started writing the blog, he understood that. But he had some funny sayings. One was, the deal of the century comes along every year.
Right.
So, you know, you don't have
to jump. It's like a 100-year flood comes along every 5 years.
Yeah, you don't have to jump on anything. There'll be another good opportunity right. 6 months from now or a year from now. He goes, oh, yeah, right. the deal of the century comes along every year.
That's great. let's talk about books. What are some of your favorite books, be they economic or otherwise fiction or nonfiction?
Well, I just finished reading, I'll mention a few economic books.
Sure.
A book called Big Shifts Ahead.
Big Shifts Ahead.
Yeah, I don't have the whole title, but that's the first
I'll post it on the site.
Yeah, I don't know if it's available yet. I read a preview. It's by Chris Porter and John Burns, both real estate guys. And Chris Porter's a demographic guy. And
this is really driven by demographic. Like Harry Dent used to be Mr. Demography.
Yeah. This book is about the shifting demographics and what it means for businesses and primarily for the real estate industry and housing. And
you enjoyed it.
And yeah, because it's something I think that's very, very important to understand. And you know, how people are going to be building different projects. And I think they did a really good job. It was very interesting to me.
What else?
I really liked, let me think, what's The House of Debt?
House of Debt. I could Sufi see and, I could see it sitting on my bookshelf on the
Amir
crisis
Sufi
page.
And,
yep.
Yeah, and Dr. I forget.
She's in California somewhere, right? Or
he? Yeah.
He.
He's. No, I think he's in the Midwest somewhere.
I'm thinking of a different book then.
Yeah,
but it's got like the torn sort of page of.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the cover looks like. But House of Debt, you can look that one up.
House of Debt. All right.
Okay, and that what they did with those two professors, what they did is they looked at microdata in available in each city to see how much household debt people had. And how that related to the strength of the recovery or the depth of the recession. And it was very, very interesting and very insightful. So, you know, the more people could borrow, obviously, the more trouble they got into.
House of Debt, how they and you caused the Great Recession.
Well, I didn't
and how
cause
we
it.
Can prevent it from happening again. Amir Sufi and Atif Mian.
Yes.
All right. And the other one was called Big Shifts.
Big Shifts Ahead by Porter and Burns.
John Burns and Chris Porter. Big Shifts Ahead, Demographic Clarity for Business. That's not coming out till October. Give me one more. What else have you read that you've really enjoyed?
Oh, The Kershak, Ben Bernanke.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I thought that was fun. It you know, it's interesting because it's just from his perspective. Now, you and I were writing about, you know, anything that's about the crisis.
The Courage to Act, a memoir of a crisis and its aftermath.
Yeah, anything about the crisis, I always disagree with something, and I'm sure you would too. But I like to see other people's perspective.
Did you really enjoy this? Because this book has been sitting on a shelf, untouched, unloved. Not even I have.
I didn't read all of it, but I read several chapters. Enjoyed
not,
it.
Not even in my queue. It's like, do I really? Although I will say, I've really enjoyed his blog.
Yeah,
I like the post crisis Bernanke better than the pre crisis. He was too blasé and too willing to, you know, rubber stamp what Greenspan was doing pre crisis, but in the midst of the crisis and after, couldn't have had a better guy there.
Well, no, when he stepped up, we were very fortunate that he was there.
Yes, and I was a big critic prior,
yeah.
And in hindsight, during the crisis, really, you want a guy who's a student of the Great Depression
of it. He was slow to react to what was happening, but then one day he woke up and said, "Holy cow, you know, and this everything I've studied all my life, it's happening right now as I'm sitting here, you know.
It's really quite amazing."
Yeah, so you know, I remember when he first got appointed by George W. Bush, and I thought,
2003, something like that.
No, it must have been. He must have taken
not as chairman, but just on the board. He was CEA, Council of Economic Advisors.
Yeah,
chair.
And that you know,
and that teed him up to go on the Fed.
Yeah, FOMC. You know, I felt sorry for him when he was the CEA because he was saying things that really didn't make sense in my view, and I thought, oh man, he's got to be political a little bit,
right?
Here.
Very.
But I was still really happy that he got appointed because you could have got anybody.
Right.
And we could have got somebody really bad who felt like the Fed shouldn't do anything.
Right.
Right. And
there are lots of people who think just let it run its course. It'll be really painful, but then we'll come out the other end cleansed and better.
Well, you know, and I, you know, you kind of understand that, except for it's not realistic, especially when you look at all the people that are seriously injured during the downturn. Instead of peaking at 10%, the unemployment rate might have peaked at 20 or 25%.
Right.
And it's not only those 20 or 25% that get hurt, it's the next 10 or 15% that are pulling way back. They're afraid they're going to lose their jobs too.
It's the paradox of thrift.
Yeah. And then you get suicides, divorces.
It's awful. The whole thing is
terrible. Yeah. I mean, you can't let that go on for 5-7 years and hope it's going to resolve itself. And besides, I think, you know, Keynes kind of pointed out that you've got a problem and it may never ever resolve itself.
Right.
But you know, if the Fed can step up and you can get some fiscal policy, gee whiz, we turned it around. From a financial crisis perspective, we turned this around better than just about anybody ever.
The rest of the world certainly is still lagging behind the U.S. All right, last two questions before they throw us out of the studio. We've been here for almost 2 hours. So a millennial or a recent college grad comes up to you and says, I'm interested in blogging, real estate, writing. What sort of advice would you give them?
Go ahead.
Have
fun. You know, look, people ask me how I built my traffic. I could ask you how you built your traffic. In my
relentlessly through 10 years of brutal work, you become an overnight sensation.
Yes, I just wrote and wrote and wrote, and people started picking up things. People liked what I wrote, picked it up, spread it around. You know, posts go viral.
Right.
And people ask me, well, how did you advertise? No, I didn't. How did you spread the word? I didn't.
Send out emails to journalists that, hey, this is an interesting piece. You should look at it.
Never. So I've never advertised it at all. So, I mean, I guess I'm advertising it now. But
you're talking about after a decade of putting it out. This is less advertising than a victory lap / retrospective. It's not like, oh, look at Bill out. Promoting, look at him hyping calculated risk. I've asked you, full disclosure, how many times have I said, hey, let's do something, let's talk about this. I recall linking to you back in, I don't know, 05, 06. I was doing the
links. That's probably where my traffic came from.
Right. I was doing the link fest for thestreet.com, and then I was doing them on The Big Picture. And I recall, and you sent like a really lovely email. I have it somewhere.
Oh, wow.
Hey, thanks for the link, but you crashed our site. You took it offline. And it wasn't like I was getting that much traffic, but in the scheme of bloggers, if you were getting 1,000 a day, that was a lot, you know, way back in the early days. But so your advice to someone who wants to start today, this late date, covering housing, would say go for it.
Yeah, I think anybody can do it. If they have something to add, you just have to work at it and put up with the low traffic to start.
Right.
And I wouldn't consider it a moneymaker. I mean, if it's somebody's career, but if it's somebody's sidelight,
something they do because they're passionate about
they're
it.
They're passionate
it's fun.
About it, and they've got something another real job, which is what really most bloggers do.
Right. What's up with you and Zero Hedge? You've written some critical things. He's not happy with me.
Oh, I have no relationship with him at all. I just think the site's a joke.
Really?
Yeah.
Because every now and then there's something of interest.
Okay.
Because he has an expertise in derivatives, what have you. But you can't find it. It's overrun with craziness.
I mean, you know, I only have so much time every day. I think this is a good lesson for everybody. Is you have to learn the sites or the newspaper journalists that you want to read.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while you branch out and pick up other people and then decide whether you want to keep reading them. You know, if I see John Hilsenrath or Nick Tamaris,
both their work.
At the Wall Street Journal, I read their article. It's just automatic. You know, I read everything by Paul Krugman. I read, you know, I have my group of people that I always read, and I branch out and read other people too.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes they fall into that group, and then I'll start reading them. If I see their name, oh, yeah. I think everybody has to have that filter. I can't waste my time going through 100 posts to find the one little nugget.
Right.
Way back when, I don't think I've been to the Zero Hedge site in 5 years.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I have friends who are always sending me stuff, and one out of five things are kind of interesting.
I know a lot of people read it. I don't know why. And you know what? Maybe they're better today. You know, maybe.
Nah, I've been blaming Zero Hedge. I've been blaming that site for hedge fund underperformance for the past 5 years. They've been relentlessly negative. They missed a giant move in equities.
Well, they were saying short in March of 2009 when the market would hit 666.
Good timing.
And they've never changed as far as
for entertainment purposes.
Well, back when I first started, and I'm sure this is true for you too, is that there was kind of like camaraderie among the blogs.
Absolutely, 100%.
And so if I saw something wrong on another site, or they saw something wrong on mine, we would exchange emails.
Hey,
and
FYI,
hey, I think that maybe you're looking at this. And it was great because then I could correct my article. Zero Hedge came along, you know, they didn't call the recession at all. Obviously, they didn't call the recovery. They didn't see the housing bubble. None of that because
they came out way after.
Yeah, they came out way after, and it was all gloom and doom, yellow journalism. But, like, somebody sent me an article from it, and I said, oh, a new site, you know, and I read it, and I said, well, I sent the guy an email, and I got the rudest reply. And I went, what the hell? Here I am reaching out. I'm not publishing it on my site. I'm not embarrassing these guys. They just...
Just FYI,
just
this
FYI,
is incorrect.
You really can't look at the data this way. You need to do this. And it's something I knew really well.
Go jump.
And you know, screw you kind of response. okay, fine.
I had a lunch with Chris Whalen, set up a lunch with him and me and a bunch of other people because I was interested in the derivative stuff he was writing about, was excellent, and the high-frequency trading stuff. He had some really good insights. And then everything all kind of went to just a degree of negativity. And
being negative drives traffic for a lot of people. You know,
I guess.
If you're constantly bearish, I always say that blogs have an incentive to be bearish because it drives traffic. It's kind of like, you know, Wall Street analysts have an incentive to be bullish, you know, it's the rare great economist on Wall Street who can say we've got a problem. The very few bloggers are willing to go both ways.
Let me ask you my very last question, my favorite question. And that is, what is it that you know about real estate, about mortgages, about writing and blogging that you wish you knew back in 2005 when you launched the site?
Well, I wish I'd met Tanta 2 years earlier as far as mortgages. Everything I know, I learned from her. So as far as real estate, you know, it was so much fun early on reading through all the technical documents at all of the sites that would provide that as to how they gathered their data. And so I really learned a lot. If I'd known that a little earlier, maybe I could have put all the pieces together just a little bit earlier. It was a weird thing in 2005. To me, I could clearly see that the market was overvalued, that there was really bad mortgages. But I kept asking myself, well, why? Why are they making these mortgages to people that are never going to pay them? I personally would never loan money to people that aren't going to pay me. You know, it took me 2 or 3 years to finally really understand how they were rating based on 1990s methodology. The methodology had changed. Mm-hmm. You had this real originate to distribute model that was just pulling, you know, people were investing in these things that they thought were AAA and they paid a higher yield than other AAAs. Well, gee whiz, you can sell an infinite amount of that because people can arbitrage between the AAAs, you know. I mean, it's crazy how that whole worked. Once you realized how that whole mechanism worked, then it was obvious how it happened. You know, I just couldn't understand originally why they'd make loans that were never going to get paid.
Well, if you can, my favorite, I did a ton of research for Bailout Nation. One of my favorite little research discoveries were that the primarily located in California, private sector mortgage lenders who would then sell it to Wall Street would sell it to Wall Street with a 90-day warranty. They would guarantee that this mortgage won't default, this 30-year mortgage won't default for 3 months.
Yeah.
Now stop and think about how misaligned those incentives are. I have a question for you that's not on my list. I have to ask because I've been thinking about it. Are we ever going to see a calculated risk book from you?
I don't think so.
Really? Because I think that could be really interesting.
It looks like a lot of work to me.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
But when you're done, I have a PhD. That's what it feels like.
Oh, okay. Well,
I think people would buy the calculated risk book, and I think it could be influential.
That's very nice of you to say.
So,
you know how much work goes into it. I know. So,
hey, listen, it's been 5 years, and I've been thinking about
when
doing
are you
going to
write
another
book.
Well, I'm just now 5 years later. I'm like, all right, maybe I'll start thinking about.
Well, you could
say 5 years. I'm sorry, it's 7 years later.
But you know, your master's in business. You've had over 100 interviews
on my list. I've had two different publishers reach out, three different publishers reach out to me. Hey, would you like to do this as a book? Sure.
I think it'd be a great book.
It could be fun.
Yeah.
Bill, thank you so much for doing this. This has just been really fascinating. For those of you who listened, I apologize for babbling. I know Bill for so long, and literally it's the first time we've actually sat down and chatted. I was very chatty, and it's because when you know someone virtually for 12 years and you finally get to sit down and talk, you feel compelled to hold up your half of the conversation. For those of you who have enjoyed this conversation, be sure to look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, and you can see any of the other 100-plus conversations we've had, which is in itself a mind-blowing data point. I would be remiss if I did not thank my producer and today's recording engineer, Charlie Vollmer, our booker, Taylor Riggs, and Mike Batnick, who is the head of research. We love your comments, feedbacks, criticisms, and other assorted responses. Be sure and write to us at mibpodcasts@bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.